Welcome to Gettin' Legal With It, a podcast for Colorado young lawyers by Colorado young lawyers. I'm your host, Kevin Chaney. For those listening to us for the first time, I'm a personal injury and criminal defense lawyer here in Colorado. I graduated from the University of Colorado Law School in 2014 and founded my practice, Chaney Galuzzi & Howard LLC, a short time later. I'm a member of the Colorado Trial Lawyers Association, where I serve on its board, executive committee, and legislative committee. I also serve on the Colorado Bar Association's Board of Governors, the CBA Executive Committee, and the CBA Young Lawyers Division Executive Council. Finally, I'm also a member of the Colorado Criminal Defense Bar Association. If you're interested in learning more about any of these wonderful organizations, please feel free to shoot me an email at kevin@cghlawfirm.com. This podcast is created and sponsored by the Colorado Bar Association's Young Lawyers Division. Our goal with this podcast is to bring you bi-weekly episodes with information that is both fun and informative for young lawyers. We have some awesome guests lined up, and we are just getting started. I'd also like to give a special shout out to Rick at Lions Bridge Recording. If you like our podcast, please, please, please leave us a review and tell your colleagues. And with that, I'd like to welcome our next guest to the podcast, Lawrence Gendelman. Lawrence was raised in the South Denver suburbs, attended Cherry Creek High School. He received his Bachelor of Arts in both economics and political science, as well as his Juris Doctor at the University of Colorado Boulder. Trained in a large family law firm, Lawrence gained experience working with high asset, high conflict, and complex divorces and child custody issues. He also advocated for and advised clients regarding the division of complex financial assets, including executive compensation packages and retirement benefits. In 2016, Lawrence transitioned his practice to probate, trust, estate law, working with a team of four other attorneys representing clients with estate planning, estate and trust administration, uncontested and contested guardianships and conservatorships, and probate litigation matters. After gaining extensive experience in these practice areas and learning law firm management and operations, Lawrence established Gendelman Law, LLC in 2017, where he represented clients in trust, estate, probate, and family law matters. In 2020, Gendelman Law Group, LLC, and Klimas Law Firm, LLC, joined forces to create Gendelman Klimas, the firm where family is everything. Besides butchering your partner's last name there, welcome to the podcast, Lawrence. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thanks, Kevin. It's a pleasure to be here.
Awesome. Well, it's a pleasure to have you as well. Why don't we just kind of start off? I know I just read the standard bio that we find on websites these days, but why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about where you're from?
Yeah, sure. So I was born in Los Angeles, and we moved out here when I think I was about 6 years old. It was 1994 after the Northridge earthquake. And then I've lived, you know, in Colorado pretty much ever since.
Basically a native. You could throw the sticker on your car.
Yeah, so I won't call native because the natives get real territorial about that term, but I'll usually just tell people I am from Colorado.
There
and,
you go.
And leave it vaguely at that.
Great lawyer answer.
Yeah, I spent 1 year out of Colorado. I did my first year of law school at Suffolk University, and then I transferred back to CU where I did my undergrad to finish up law school.
So obviously you did your undergrad at CU. Did you want to, I guess, kind of stay in Colorado, or what was kind of your thinking in kind of going to Boulder?
Oh, that's a good question. I originally did, when I was in high school, I didn't plan on staying in Colorado. I think I wanted to, you know, to get out and see the rest of the world. And I was looking at some schools that I'm trying to remember where I was even looking at anymore, but outside Colorado, I know I was looking at some on the East Coast, I think California as well. I think there was one I was looking at in Wisconsin, but ultimately I got into CU. I wanted to do business. I wanted to be a business major, and I actually did not get into the business school at CU.
Okay.
So I ended up at CU, I think, because it was a good school. It's where my mom went to school, and I was able to get in-state tuition, so it kind of all added up. And then I did economics and political science. I mostly did economics just because I didn't get in the business school, and I was like, oh, I'll need to...
It's close enough, right?
It's close enough. It's tangential. And I ended up really enjoying economics.
And so... you said that you kind of envisioned yourself going to the business school. When did law school, I guess, kind of come into the picture? When did you start thinking like, hey, this might be a path for me?
Well, so as I think you know, Kevin, I'm Jewish. So sort of growing up, and I get to say this, the understanding was my choices were doctor or lawyer. But yeah, no, the real way that I ended up going to law school is I did a leadership certificate at the University of Colorado as part of my undergrad. And I did an internship with the probation department up there for that certificate.
Okay. Up in Boulder?
Up in Boulder. So I really enjoyed the internship. And then I ended up doing a year after the internship as a contract probation officer for the state.
Sure.
Working in Boulder. And I really enjoyed that work too. I realized though through that work that I enjoyed being a probation officer, I didn't necessarily want to do that for the rest of my life.
Right, right.
It didn't have quite the level, and not to say it's not a difficult job because it's a very difficult job, but it didn't have the level of like intellectual rigor and challenge that I was necessarily looking for.
Sure.
And yeah, so my goal was to go become a DA. I wanted to kind of understand how people got there in the first place, how they got to probation.
Right.
And that's why I decided originally to go to law school, was to go be a DA.
Okay. And did you know you wanted to go to law school in Boulder still? Had you kind of fallen in love, I guess, with that town at that point? Or did you consider kind of going out of state for a while?
With respect to law school, I know I applied. I think I applied to like 12 or 13 different law schools. CU was the goal when I was applying.
Sure.
And my undergrad GPA was not great. I probably just had too much fun in Boulder.
There you go.
But yeah, so I didn't get into CU the first time. I ended up going to Suffolk because they gave me what was, you know, close to a full ride. It was a lot. It was like a three-quarter scholarship.
Nice.
And I did really well there. And then I decided, hey, maybe I can transfer. Maybe I can go back to Colorado. And I applied to CU as a transfer student, and I got in. I was really, really lucky.
And when you, at what point, I guess, during law school did you decide, hey, maybe the DA path isn't the one for me? Because obviously you're not a DA now. Was there a specific moment that happened, or was it kind of a gradual change?
So I worked for the Boulder County DA when I was a 2L.
Okay.
So I did my first semester there just sort of in county court, helping with the typical county court things, you know, low-level domestic violence charges, DUIs, traffic tickets, you know, theft, the such.
Yep.
And I enjoyed that. It was fine. Then the second semester, I was on a jail docket. So every day three times a week, I think, after class, I would go to the Boulder County Jail, and I would help the DA that was there with basically dealing with all the people who were picked up the night before. It was a lot of bond hearings.
Right.
A lot of it was just seeing if we could, you know, plea people out before they even got into the system and got to an arraignment that would occur at the courthouse.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is where I realized that wasn't necessarily a system that I wanted to be a part of.
Mm-hmm.
And I have nothing against DAs. I mean, it's an important job, and it's a hard job, and it's a necessary job, but it wasn't something I necessarily wanted to do. And I knew that I would have trouble for committing to that for the rest of my life. That was not going to comport with my values.
Right.
Largely, I really struggled with how the law seemed to be enforced and applied to people of color. I also really struggled with how I felt that the law was being used as a mechanism to essentially, I don't know, house homeless people and deal with mental health issues that could otherwise be dealt with in much more effective ways.
Right.
So that wasn't a system that I was comfortable working in every day and supporting and being able to sleep at night.
And I hear you. It's tough. The criminal justice system, obviously, I work, on the other side of it. It can be very draining because and it's hard for one person alone, especially if you are not the elected DA, to really have the power to kind of change that setup. So you realize that, you know, maybe being a DA wasn't for you. This wasn't necessarily the long-term career. How did you go about, I guess, figuring out what it is you did want to do?
Yeah, I didn't really know what to do once I decided that I wasn't going to be a DA. So at that point, I was done with my first 2 years of law school.
Okay.
I'm going to my third year. And I'm like, what do I do? I came here to be a DA, and I'm not going to do that now.
Right.
So I end up going with the Entrepreneurial Law Clinic my 3L year, thinking, hey, maybe business law would be a really good fit for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I did the Entrepreneurial Law Clinic. I really enjoyed that as well. I liked helping small business, you know, owners and helping people with their startups and with their ideas, and that was a great experience. Ultimately, it still didn't quite fit for me. Being a transaction lawyer day in and day out, just it didn't, I don't know exactly what the words are for it, but right. It didn't quite inspire me the way I needed to be inspired to make it my career.
Right.
I, at some point, my second semester of 3L, just 3L year, just started applying for jobs. I don't even know if I knew what I was really applying for or I was looking. I was like, I just need to like make sure I have a job.
That's right.
I
got to pay rent.
Yeah. That, I mean, I think that was it. And then I applied for a family law firm and I ended up getting it. And I worked there for about 5 months. And that's how I started in family law.
It's so interesting. So this is one of the questions I always ask people on here. And I expected about half or maybe more than half of people to have kind of this linear path. Where, you know, they got to law school, they knew exactly what they wanted to do, they took the classes they needed to take, and they ended up going into that career. And maybe I thought maybe it'd be like 50-50. I think we've shot about 28 or 29 episodes or so far. Rick, our sound guy, is nodding his head. So I think we're at about 28 or 29, and I think maybe only one person has had a linear path. Almost every single individual we talk to, they're either some of them, it was like a, you know, come to Jesus moment where there was just something happened and they were like, this isn't for me. Or they realized that, you know, gradually that it wasn't necessarily going to be the field they wanted to. And it does seem to be right around that 2L year where you see this kind of pivot and everything. So it's always fascinating for me. And I bring that up and I always point this out in the episodes because I really do think it's important for law students who make up a fair amount of our listeners. It's okay to not know. Mm-hmm. It's okay to, you know, get all the way in and be like, you know what, this is not what I want to do for the rest of my life. And as you said, you know, sometimes you just start applying for jobs, you know, not really knowing which one it's you're going to be. And, you know, now you've found a practice area that you've been able to build a business, which I guess is a great transition. So obviously, as of today, you own your own firm, now have a partner and things. Mm-hmm. When did you decide while you were working that, hey, you know, maybe I want to launch my own firm rather than kind of work for another one?
Yeah, so I was at my second job out of law school. And at that point, I think I'd probably been a lawyer for a year and a half to 2 years.
Okay.
Yeah, I never really loved working for other people. I'm a fairly independent person,
right?
And I'm probably overconfident in believing that I somehow can do things better, than other people. And I, you know, which I think that's actually really important to have some, you have to have pretty good confidence if you're going to go out on your own and make it,
right?
Regardless if that confidence might be reckless at times. But yeah, no, I mean, I looked at how law firms ran and how law firms operated and how they were, sometimes serving client needs, but not always serving client needs, and oftentimes not being able to serve a lot of clients who were deserving of representation otherwise. And I said to myself, I think there's just a better way to do this, and maybe I can do it. And yeah, so I decided after, I feel like it was about a year and a half, 2 years of practice, to go out on my own and do Gendelman Law Group. Where it was, you know, pretty much just me. I had a contract attorney who was also helping a little bit, and it just kind of, it grew way quicker than I had expected. I was very pleasantly surprised.
You know, that's awesome, man. And congratulations for, you know, it's been really fun watching your firm grow. For our listeners, Lawrence and I office in the same building. So I do get to see him on a regular basis, and it's been awesome kind of watching your firm grow. You know, at the beginning you said, you know, you kind of realized that you weren't necessarily cut out to work for somebody else. And I think that's an important thing for people to kind of think about, because there are a lot of people that really, really like it. They don't want the responsibility of having their name on the door. They don't want the responsibility of having to find clients. They're like, you know, tell me what to do. I'm happy to work really hard, you know, and get a paycheck. But that's not necessarily true for everybody. You know, I went to law school wanting to be a public defender, and I love the public defender program. We have probably the best one in the country. But what I ultimately realized is that it was essentially a giant law firm, you know, and you had a boss, and that boss had a boss, and that boss had a boss, mm-hmm. and that boss had a boss. And unless you were going to be there about, you know, 20 or 30 years, you probably were never going to get to do things exactly kind of how you wanted, because there were always going to be kind of these, not bureaucracy, but kind of just these rules and stuff and the way that things had to be done. And that was one of my big inspirations for being like, hey, let's go out on my own or kind of see how it is. What was the most difficult thing kind of that first year or two?
The most difficult thing, I think it's honestly psychological. It's not even like a real tangible thing. It's just, you know, believing in yourself and just keeping going when it feels like there are moments that you're just like not going to make it. You know, that constant worry of where is the next client going to come in from? Is this, you know, person going to pay their bill? And just that constant anxiety. I think for me, you know, I'm someone who certainly, and I recognize this, you know, at this point in my life, but I really do listen to what people say, and I really do consider it perhaps too much. I probably think a little bit too much of what other people say to me or think about me.
Uh-huh.
And it was really hard. And I'm sure that you experienced this to some extent too. All the people who tell you that you can't do it.
Oh yeah.
That was one of the hardest things for me, was to get beyond all the people who are like, What are you doing? You're like 27 years old. You can't do this. You don't know how ethics stuff works. You don't like know how these big cases work. You haven't, you know, been part of these multi-million dollar things before on your own. And I think it was really hard for me to kind of, I don't know, like it felt almost deviant. all these people telling me I couldn't do it. And me being like, no, like, I'm pretty sure that I can. And I think that was the hardest part, was me just telling myself, look, like, these other people's opinions don't really matter.
I've never told this story on a public podcast, don't hate me, but my our dean at the time we were in law school, who is now our attorney general, mm-hmm. Phil Weiser, who I absolutely love, and he's a great attorney general, and he was a great dean, but he told my partner and I that there was no way that we could open up a firm after we graduated, and that we had to go clerk or that we had to go somewhere else. And we literally had that hanging up on our wall for at least the first 6 months.
Was this an email or something?
It wasn't an email, but I wrote it down, and I was like, Dean Weiser thinks this is a bad idea, and put it on a sticky note, and we put it up there. And it was. It was really great motivation, and I credit him in many ways mm-hmm. for that. And it was tough. He had a lot of really good points, but it was great. It was great. That was something we used. Well, just one last question, and then I want to jump into kind of our main topic for the day. If you had to give one piece of advice to a young lawyer or a law student who is thinking about opening up their own firm, what would that be?
I think I would say, number one, don't listen to the people who tell you that you can't do it. If you are listening to them, do exactly what you did, Kevin. Use that to propel yourself to say, no, I definitely can do it. I know that you asked for one piece of advice, but I'm just going to give three. I'd say have a lot of mentors. You really can't have too many mentors when you're just starting. I feel like, you know, my first five cases, I ran into issues that I just didn't feel comfortable with dealing on my own and didn't know how to solve. Mm-hmm. And I had to call somebody and I had to talk through it. And I guess my third piece would be, expect it to be really, really hard. you will work more, guaranteed, you know, right when you're starting your own law firm. In that first year, I mean, I was probably doing six coffees a week with, you know, just people in the industry or people who I thought might be able to give me referrals or business. I probably worked every weekend or almost every weekend for that first year.
Right.
Because it all falls on you.
Yeah.
Those are my three pieces of advice.
Awesome. All right. Well, we're going to shift gears here to a completely different topic. I always reach out to our guests and say, hey, you know, what do you want to talk about? What do you think would be fun or interesting for young lawyers and law students? And Lawrence proposed a really interesting one, and one that we have not even come close to addressing on this podcast. And I think he recently gave a presentation up on it in Boulder. Was that right? Up in Boulder?
Yeah, there were four or five attorneys from family law firms in Denver, including one of the other attorneys at my firm, Nicola uh-huh. Winter, and we had done a presentation in Boulder. I can't remember exactly when it was now. It feels like it was just before the pandemic.
Okay. And so that topic was non-monogamy and the law, with kind of a focus on family law. So That is going to be our primary topic for today. Lawrence, before we dive into kind of the specifics, can you kind of, what is non-monogamy? You see all these terms kind of flying around, and you know, some of our listeners may know kind of what they are, but some of them may be like, I see that, but I don't really know what it means. Can you kind of just set the stage for us a little bit?
Yeah, and let me just be clear. I am not an expert here on non-monogamy or polygamy or polyamory or anything like that. So I'm going to focus, obviously, my presentation more on kind of the legal pieces than
sure.
the social pieces. But yes, so all that to say, if I screw up a term, and you know, I apologize. It's not done with any malice. So yeah, when I'm using the term non-monogamy for the purpose of this discussion, I'm really trying to use as an umbrella term to encapsulate any type of relationship between two people that is not necessarily sexually and or emotionally exclusive.
Okay.
That's going to be my umbrella definition. So this can include, you know, what people refer to as open relationships, where they might be sexually active with people other than their partner.
Mm-hmm.
It might incorporate swinging. It could incorporate polyamory, where people are not necessarily emotionally exclusive. Perhaps they have different types of emotional relationships with different people, more than one.
Mm-hmm.
It could involve polygamy, which I think we all probably know under Colorado law is not legal. I don't know much about that on the national front, but I assume that that polygamy is not legal in any state. I know that it's
That's
a common,
my understanding. Yeah.
Yeah. I know it's a common practice among individuals. That doesn't necessarily mean, I shouldn't say individuals. There are certain cultures. The Mormon culture certainly is well known for engaging in polygamy, but that, you know, the relationship might be acknowledged within a church or within a community. That doesn't mean it's necessarily recognized by the government.
Sure.
But in Colorado, polygamy is considered criminal and is against the law. But yeah, polygamy being married to more than one person at the same time. And yeah, so all of those could be encapsulated under non-monogamy. And I'm sure there's a whole assortment of how relationships can look within non-monogamy that are perhaps not, you know, encapsulated in any of those specific examples I gave.
Sure. What are some of the legal issues or family law issues that can sometimes come up in these relationships?
What I'll start with is that the law generally, and this is just for all law that we have in the United States, that in any way involves families or you know, marriages or parenting or anything of the like, they're just not written right for these types of situations. They're not written for situations where there is an intent to have more than one spouse, or there are three people who are living together or five people who are living together in committed partnerships where they want to have, where they're looking to share not only love, but also the economic benefits that would come along with having a committed relationship that people who are in a, you know, monogamous relationship would get.
Right.
The law just isn't written for that, and it's not written like that. In fact, as we just discussed, polygamy specifically is outlawed in every
right.
state in the country.
Right.
So not only not acknowledged, and not only does the law not necessarily have room for it, the law has explicitly excluded these relationships in many respects for being applied. So yeah, there's, I think one place to start is just realizing that there aren't civil right protections at all, right, for someone who is non-monogamous or for, you know, a couple that, or I shouldn't say a couple, but for individuals that are non-monogamous.
What would some of those, I guess, kind of be? I guess I'm thinking of maybe an employer could fire someone who is in a non-monogamous relationship.
Yeah, and I don't know much about employment law, let me be clear, but I certainly am not. Yeah, it's my understanding that somebody who practices non-monogamy, could they be fired for that potentially?
Right.
I don't know that there would necessarily be like any kind of traditional, you know, employment-related
right.
or civil right claim there. So yeah, I guess just acknowledging that there aren't necessarily protections, but let me actually answer your question because I haven't, which was specific to family law.
Right.
So when we're looking at parenting, for example, our law in Colorado, it's under Title 19, is pretty clear that you can only have two parents. There is case law that where regarding the potential for a third parent in Colorado has specifically said, no, we are not going to acknowledge a three parent situation. So I think that's one example of where the law just isn't particularly, I mean, it's not written to encompass these types of relationships where perhaps more than two people are looking to jointly parent a child.
Is that true even in like a step-parent situation? Can a step-parent not legally adopt a child to make him have three parents? Or
they can, but along with that step-parent adoption petition, there's also a petition to terminate the parental rights of someone else's rights.
Oh, so it can only be two. So if the step-parent becomes the legal parent, the biological parent has to be removed.
Correct.
Those
are granted usually simultaneously.
I never knew that. That is interesting. So three is a no-go in all situations in Colorado.
Now, not to get super confusing, there are ways that a third person can have some parental rights, but they are not a parent.
Wow.
So you can have allocations of parental responsibilities to a non-parent. That's a thing that happens as well. And that's usually happening under the Domestic Relations Code in Title 14. But in terms of actually being a parent under Title 19, which is the Juvenile Code, that you only get two. With that said, there are states that have started to acknowledge the possibility of third parents. And I'm not an expert on this, but there certainly are some out there. And I know that California has somewhat recently done some modifications of, I don't know if it was case law or if it was by statute, but they're willing to entertain this idea of three parent situations. But Colorado is not there.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Let's just look at like the Domestic Relations Code. So let's say there are more than two people who want to be in and, you know, some kind of intimate relationship and are seeking to have their relationship treated to be akin of those who are married, right?
Right.
With respect to the sharing of, let's say, property rights specifically. The law obviously doesn't accommodate for that, right? You can only be married to one person. So in a divorce, you can only get divorced to one person. The law just isn't written in a way that there is a third person who can have an allocation of property or that can receive alimony or spousal maintenance. Or any of the other, you know, things that might, an allocation of debts, whatever might be getting divided in a divorce. The law just doesn't have room for that. The Domestic Relations Code is not written for that.
Okay. Is there a workaround? So I assume this may be true with property, but probably not with the children. Is there a workaround via contract?
That's a great question. Is there a workaround via contract? This is something that we toyed with at the discussion that we had at Boulder on this issue. And ultimately, I think what the consensus was from that group, from a probate perspective as well as a family law perspective, was that if you really were to have more than two people that want to be treated somewhat akin to what a married couple would be treated like for the purposes of divorce or death, no one would be able to get married. The idea is no one gets married and the whole thing would probably need to be creation of private contract.
Wow.
You would utilize trust agreements and then you could utilize just some type of, it would be almost like a cohabitation agreement. It'd be
right,
a cohabitation
right.
agreement between three people or four people or however many. And then I think that you also have some accompanying estate planning
right.
that would go along with it. And it would probably have to be a trust-based estate plan. But if two of the people in however many people are in this relationship are married, it is almost impossible to create a situation where there is going to be equal treatment among all of them.
Because the law is going to consider their stuff kind of marital property, and then there's just going to be like this third person kind of hanging out there. Is that kind of one of the issues?
That is the ultimate issue. There are some ways to try to accommodate for that. So, for example, prenuptial agreements and postnuptial agreements could be used to contract specifically around some of those issues with respect to property or ways or waivers of maintenance or whatnot. But there still ends up being an issue here, even if you use a premarital or postmarital agreement, to, I guess, what you'd be doing is sort of not treat the marriage, I don't even know, as a marriage for the purpose of property and treat as something else. It would get kind of weird, but the issue is that there'd be a standing issue. That would be the big one. So, right, this other person or these other people who just aren't parties to the agreement at all, to the premarital agreement or postmarital agreement, that's only going to be between the married people.
Right.
They don't really have a way to get their foot in the door
if
there's a problem because they're just not parties to the agreement and they just don't have standing. So, yeah, what we decided, as I recall, was that if you're looking to have, you know, an agreement between more than two people regarding division of, you know, property, debt at divorce or death, it really just has to be a total matter of private contract, and no one should be married. Now, I say that from the perspective of, you know, dealing with assets and debts, but from the parenting perspective, there can definitely be different considerations. I don't deal with adoption law, for example. I do like step-parent adoptions, but I don't deal with a lot of adoptions, I should say. But I know that the practitioners who really focus in the adoption area and practitioners who focus in artificial reproductive technology would tell you that there can be some reason or applicability for couples to be married when they're trying to, you know, when they're trying to have a child or adopt a child by the variety of means that exist out there. There can be certain benefits to marriage.
So the short answer is this is just extremely complicated if you're going to be in this kind of relationship to figure out a way to make it mimic a multi-person marriage. There's, you know, considerations for the child end, but then there's also considerations for the property and finances and all of that as well.
Right. And what's good for one might not be good for the other.
Right.
And yeah, I mean, this is the exact issue, is that the law just is, it's not even written in a way that that doesn't provide necessarily for people who are going to be in non-monogamous relationships. It is really averse to people who are in non-monogamous relationships.
What about, so this was something, you know, as you know, gay rights and stuff was kind of coming out, there was always these issues with like hospital visitation,
mm-hmm.
And kind of medical wills and medical decision making. How does that work into like a non-monogamous relationship? Is that something that kind of contract law can address, or can you do like a medical will where you give multiple people, you know, like I give these three people by, you know, majority vote decision making over me, or can you only assign that decision making to basically like one person?
So I think for the purpose of like what you're talking about, I think is like a durable power of attorney, like a medical durable power of attorney. And for that purpose, yeah, you can have more than, you know, than one person as your agent under power of attorney. It certainly doesn't, even if you're married, it does not have to be your spouse. You could have, you know, children or other people in your lives who are listed on there. So I don't think that it's necessarily an issue from that perspective. The probate perspective, and when I say probate in this context, I'm talking about death. That one, we run into a lot of these same issues that I was just identifying for, you know, for marriage and breakups, where the probate code, you know, doesn't really have a way to account for, you know, intestacy rights for somebody who has more than two parents, because we also can't have more than two parents. And, you know, that obviously could have an impact on children of these relationships.
Do you think, and I know this is kind of asking you to kind of look into the future.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that the law is eventually, so obviously, you know, we kind of saw a lot of these workarounds with, you know, kind of monogamous LGBT relationships. And as we kind of got to, you know, same-sex marriage, we had civil unions and different kind of contract law before that. And then the law eventually, in at least most states, eventually caught up and things kind of changed. Do you see that happening with non-monogamous relationships? Like, do you see that eventually it's going to get to a point where people are like, look, this is absurd. We mm-hmm. need to change the law to allow people to have the protection for their children, their assets that they want, you know, that consenting adults want?
That's a fantastic question, Kevin. And first, I'm going to address some of your statements. And what we're seeing with non-monogamous individuals, it really does look like what we have seen in the past with LGBT couples. It was not that long ago that LGBT couples were doing the exact same thing that non-monogamous couples were also doing at the time and are now doing, in just trying to figure out a way to work with a law that only acknowledged relationships between, you know, a married man and a married woman, and that's really it.
Right.
Or that you could only have, you know, a mother and a father, and a child could not have two fathers or could not have two mothers. So, I think these workarounds that we're talking about, they're not unfamiliar in that sense. There have always been, you know, members of our community who have been subject to have to figure out how to work with these workarounds just in order to have their relationships honored and acknowledged. So to your actual question, though, I do have an opinion on this. And so I'm sure many people who are listening to the podcast are familiar with or have heard of the Obergefell decision, which mm-hmm. is the one that essentially, you know, made it so in every state, people of the same same sex or same gender, you know, can be married, and any law that says otherwise is deemed to be unconstitutional. It's my summary of Obergefell. And if you look at the dicta and you look at the reasoning behind that opinion and a lot of the other opinions that did similar things on the state level, I think it really, really bodes well for people in non-monogamous relationships, right? The fundamental right at issue that is articulated consistently in these opinions regarding same-sex marriage is the right to, you know, to right to love the one who you want, the freedom to marry the one that you love. And I don't see how that fundamental right as articulated would not be able to apply to non-monogamous, you know, individuals. And I guess we're not talking about the one that you love necessarily, or but the ones that you love. I don't know how hard it really is to put an S, you know, at the end of that articulated fundamental right, and then have that apply to, you know, people who are non-monogamous. So I think that the dicta is there. I think that the logic is there. It doesn't feel to me like a huge step to go from where we are from just a legal perspective to, you know, a place where people who are, you know, where polygamy could be legal, or, you know, where non-monogamous relationships could somehow be recognized for the purpose of parenting or probate or whatnot. From that perspective, I think that it is something that is on the horizon. I am sure that, you know, and I don't know enough about the movement and if there really are movements that are trying to move toward this actively right now. I suspect we will be there, and I suspect that we will, you know, be there within the next 50 years. I am not a constitutional law scholar. Let me be very clear on that. The other piece I do want to mention is that you know, with when we're dealing with polygamy and we're dealing with, you know, non-monogamy, obviously there's a lot of history that comes along with these practices and these terms, just like, you know, with LGBT individuals as well. And you know, the way that non-monogamy and polygamy have been practiced at different points, you know, with different groups of people at different points in time, sometimes, you know, people may look at it and say, well, that was, you know, that was terrible, right? That was really inequitable.
And there wasn't consent in those relationships,
right?
A lot
consent,
of times.
Yeah. And for the most part, you know, women were the ones who were getting, you know, not just the short end of the stick, but were really, really getting victimized in a lot of
right,
these relationships.
Right.
So I don't want to not acknowledge that there, you know, is a history with polyamory and non-monogamy that isn't, you know, isn't necessarily pretty as well. So my other follow-up here is in terms of, you know, how feasible it really is that we're going to see, you know, non-monogamous or polyamorous or polygamous relationships, you know, acknowledged in the law in the future. Obviously, that's going to require a massive overhaul of law, right?
Right.
And you know, there's so many different you know, statutory schemes and regulatory schemes that would have to be adjusted accordingly. What I would also note, though, is that we've sort of done that, slash we are doing it right now with respect to LGBT relationships. You know, the tax code is, you know, a fine example, right? The tax code is obviously going to have to change if somehow polygamy, you know, were to be recognized by the federal government.
Right.
I don't know how the tax code exactly would change, but like, you know, the typical married filing jointly and married filing separately and the way the deductions work. I mean, all of that would somehow
have to
get adjusted. But the tax code had to get altered and adjusted when LGBT people got the right to marry as well.
Right.
So I think a lot of times, you know, these, I don't know, like the fact that so many changes might have to happen with respect to, you know, regulatory schemes and statutory schemes can be used as an excuse to not make progress. But I don't find that to be persuasive.
Right. You know, it's interesting. You hit on a lot of topics, and the major, you know, same-sex marriage decision was one of them. I remember listening to oral argument, and I think it was Justice Scalia who asked a question about, like, well, then why not polygamy? And the attorney kind of punted to be like, that's not what we're talking about here. But I mean, I think the answer to the question is kind of like, yeah, why not? You know, why, if we're going to allow a consenting adults to, if love is a constitutional right, essentially, which is really what you see in like the Loving decision. And then you also see in, you know, Justice Kennedy's decision. And I always butcher the pronunciation, but in the major same-sex marriage decision, is that there's a constitutional right to essentially love who you love. And if government is going to recognize any relationship based on love, then what grounds does it have to basically pick and choose, you know, what love is real? And I do think you make a really good point that there's going to be a lot of areas of law that are going to require some rewriting. And we're going to have to kind of expand on, you know, what we thought was normal and what we thought that the law, you know, should be. But there doesn't really seem to be any legitimate reason to, you know, if three people want to get married to each other, why can't they call their assets marital property? Like, why can't their incomes be joint? You know, it doesn't, there doesn't seem to be any constitutional or logical, you know, consistency to support kind of that view.
And yeah, I fully agree. I definitely support that view. And I, yeah, I have a similar outlook on it. I think that the key I would focus on there is the consent piece, right?
Yep.
All of this works as long as you have consenting adults, you know, who are in these, who are in consenting relationships and who are freely agreeing to be subject to, you know, those statutory schemes or those regulations or, you know, whatever those state law provisions are regarding their relationship. And again, there is a certain history of the of these relationships not always being consensual.
And I think you're right, because, yeah, you and I think polygamy especially gets a really bad rap because how it has been practiced openly in America has often been found in really fundamentalist communities. Mm-hmm. And they're oftentimes, you know, consent is questionable at best in a lot of those situations. And every now and then you'll see a federal raid and, you know, there's a bunch of children, for lack of a better term, basically being forced to marry either cult leaders or, you know, different type of fundamentalist leaders. And it's really, you know, giving people a negative connotation. And,
right.
And I think that that what we're talking about and kind of where the focus would be here is really something completely different.
Right. That is a consent issue.
That is a consent issue. That is wrong. And that would be wrong. You know, it would be wrong if it was a monogamous relationship.
Right.
You know, it'd be, you know, if someone's forcing a 14-year-old to marry him, that's wrong. If it's, even if that's his only wife or her only wife, it's probably his wife in those situations most of the time. But yeah, that would be wrong then, you know, and it doesn't really necessarily, you know, change.
So I just wanted to point out one other thing, which is the Uniform Law Commission did actually, I don't know if they weren't trying to address this issue specifically, but they were circulating, I think it started in 2018, an Economic Right of Unmarried Cohabitant Act. It doesn't have any specific inclusions for non-monogamous relationships, and I think that they were actually specifically excluded. But yeah, I would note in terms of the cohabitation agreement discussion that we had, you know, the cohabitation agreements, at least, you know, in Colorado, you're not going to find express laws that say they are valid and here's how they're interpreted and here's how they are applied.
Right.
And we don't have, you know, any kind of statutory scheme for that. And I don't think that many states do. I don't know for sure, but there have been attempts to try to at least have some kind of, you know, some kind of rules that can be interstate to promote the predictability of how unmarried people who are in committed relationships will have their relationships treated as a matter of private contract. And we don't necessarily have that yet.
Well, it's just a super interesting area of law, you know, both from a policy standpoint, but also from a legal standpoint. And I think it's going to be interesting to watch this develop. I do want to shift gears here with our last little bit of time that we have and talk a little bit about the LGBT bar. I know that you are have been active in that bar. Can you tell us a little bit about, you know, what it is and kind of what roles you've had there?
Yeah, so LGBT bar, we're the Colorado LGBT Bar Association. And yeah, we have a lot of different things, as any of the you know, minority bar associations do. We're fairly active with respect to doing interviews for judicial candidates, and, you know, doing recommendations or letters to the governor for judicial candidates, kind of doing some vetting to make sure that the people who are getting through that process have some level of knowledge regarding LGBT issues, specifically legal issues, that they will, you know, be good judicial officers for LGBT litigants who appear before them or when dealing with LGBT issues. We also have public policy work that we do. We have, you know, done some lobbying at the legislature when there are specific bills that come up that impact the LGBT community. I remember that there was one specifically I went and spoke on regarding adoption agencies could essentially discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation. But yeah, there are very important bills that come through every session that we're able to lobby on. In addition, what else? We obviously have fun programming, and we have an annual dinner. We have a judicial reception that we do each year. We have a newsletter. Yeah, and it's you know, it's excellent networking, and it's an excellent way for people to get involved.
And correct me if I'm wrong, you were either the outgoing president or you're the incoming president, right? Or at some point, weren't you president of the bar?
Yeah, so I started with the Colorado LGBT bar when I was in law school. I was a law student liaison, did that for a couple years, and I was the secretary, and I was a programming chair. And then I was the incoming, or the president-to-be, whatever we called that person. And then I was president for 2020.
Okay, nice.
So now I'm the immediate past president.
And would you, I guess, encourage law students and young lawyers to kind of get involved in that or maybe another affinity bar?
Absolutely. I mean, you've mentioned how mentorship has been a topic on this show that continues to come up, and it's definitely one that I brought up too. And there's no better place than, you know, a minority bar or any of the bar associations, honestly, for mentorship. I think that it's really important for law students to be able to connect with lawyers who are in their community, who mm-hmm. they have something in common with, whether that be, you know, a common identity or a common passion. If right. they have an interest in fighting for LGBT rights, get involved in the LGBT Bar Association. Get yourself a mentor who can tell you what that looks like. Someone who you can call when you have, you know, questions that come up, whether it's because you've started your own law firm and you don't know what you're doing, or, you know, if you're just in practice and need some guidance. I think, you know, the connections that you can make in bar associations is so powerful. And I know that, you know, there are 20 people in my phone I can call right now that I've met through the LGBT Bar Association that will pick up my call, that will talk to me about a case or talk to me about an issue that I'm having. And that is just one of the most powerful things that you can have in terms of just accelerating your own practice and being a good lawyer.
And I think you really hit the nail on the head when you were talking about mentors. And it's important to have a lot of different types of mentors, mm-hmm. right? Like, you want maybe mentors in your practice area. You maybe want like an ethics mentor, somebody you call when you have like an ethics issue, you know, is either super ethical or knows a lot about ethics. You may want a law firm mentor, somebody who runs their own law firm or is kind of at where you're at. And then, you know, I like that you kind of talked about like having a mentor who has a similar identity or somebody who can relate to, you know, I guess this is my privilege showing, but I wouldn't even know like what the different issues that may arise for mm-hmm. an LGBT lawyer, right? And so someone talking to me about that, you know, I wouldn't be able to mentor them on that issue, but being able to find someone who has that shared identity or may be able to relate to some shared experiences may be able to mentor you in a different way and provide different insight than, you know, some of your other mentors.
Yeah. Nope, absolutely.
Well, that's actually a great place to end on, the same way I end every episode, because we believe at this podcast that mentors are so important. Would you be willing to, if any of our young lawyers or law students wanted to reach out and talk about anything that we've talked about today, whether that is, you know, doing family law, estate planning, that kind of stuff, running your own firm, talking about non-monogamy and the law, or just being LGBT and a lawyer, or getting involved in that bar association, would you be willing to speak to those people if they were to reach out?
Yeah, absolutely.
And what is your email address, or what's the best way to get a hold of you?
Yeah, email is great, and I'll go ahead and spell it out because my name, it's kind of long. So Lawrence, LAURENCE, at GendelmanKlimas.com. Which is GendelmanKlimas.com.
And we'll also, we'll throw a link in the description to this on most of the podcast websites with that information as well. Lawrence, thank you so much for coming on the podcast and speaking about a really unique and interesting topic that I do think is going to be eventually a civil rights issue is ultimately what I think it's going to be hopefully the not so distant future. So thank you so much for your time, and always a pleasure.
Absolutely, Kevin. Thanks so much for asking me to do this. It really is a pleasure. Get legal with it.